Today's episode deals with one of the most difficult situations that any family can find themselves in, and that is the loss of a loved one in death. In today's episode, our guest that we interviewed experienced two tragedies: the loss of one brother in a motorcycle accident and the loss of another brother by means of suicide. He shared with us the ups, the downs, the emotional roller coaster that he has experienced during that period of time, but he will also share with us how he is a survivor, letting us know that you can still make it. So stay tuned for the upcoming interview.
You're listening to The Critical Thought, where we challenge our listeners to use critical thinking when examining the teachings of Jehovah's Witnesses.
Hi, this is JT.
And this is Lady C.
Welcome to another episode of The Critical Thought. And so we would like to give our audience an opportunity to see, like we have said so many times before, we think that your experience is one of those experiences that shows people that despite what you have experienced, there is indeed life after Watchtower.
So Lisa and Nash, we want to welcome you all to the program.
Great to be here.
So how old were you when you got baptized?
11.
It's amazing that you can't drive, you can't buy alcohol or beer or anything, no. But you can sign a contract that will bound you for the rest of your entire life at 11 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the crazy thing is I've had these conversations in recent years with my parents when they would talk to me, and that I brought that up. Right. And they bring it up. They say, you made this choice. And I say that to him, like, there's no way an 11-year-old is ready for that choice. We don't let them choose all kinds of things at 11. Definitely not something that affects your whole life. So,
yeah, I think that the case that you built with what's going on with your family, losing a brother, father, being hurt, and all the things that was happening, you were making emotional decisions, and it was all based on the indoctrination. Because I know you probably felt like you would probably see your brother again. Did you feel like that?
Yeah, for sure. And I felt like it would bring my family kind of back together because it was fractured from then on, right? And it just wasn't the same. And so you just, as a kid, I think you just want it to be the same. And that was the answer in my mind at the time.
Yeah, that's what that's part of the indoctrination, Dave. Anything that happens at that point in a person's life, the ultimate goal is you got to get into the new system if you want to see your loved ones again. And so that just grinds on a lot of people over a period of time. But you had mentioned that, that you had lost. Now, this was your older brother?
Yeah, older. So he was the oldest at all of us. Yeah.
Okay.
So then I guess from then on, my two then oldest, I guess, the next to him, they moved away, province away. So it was just the three younger siblings left. Jared was one older than my younger one. And so it just felt weird. The house was empty all of a sudden. It went from six of us to, this kind of depression and just the three of us left. And Jared just kind of, he switched over to homeschooling and went to work with my dad. My dad was in construction. And I switched to homeschooling that year too. For grade six, and my youngest brother, my mom pulled him out of school. Actually, I think he might have done grade one, but in grade two, a kid pulled a jackknife or something stupid on him, and she pulled him out and homeschooled him from the rest. But John, I don't even think he finished grade six, to be honest. I know my mom, because he struggled with school anyway, because he never really had that first bit of public school, and so my mom would try and help him, but she wasn't in a good place to help herself even. And so she would end up kind of doing his work for him just to get it done, because he was a pretty stubborn kid. And I would just do mine on my own. And I got it done because I've always kind of put my mind to things and do them. The schools got to the point where they kept like passing him a grade if he would go back. So I don't even know what he actually has for schooling. He's done okay. He's done fine, surprisingly. But the only one of us, it's fine, like just a small thought on education in our family. The only Only my second oldest brother, Nathan, graduated high school. He went right from kindergarten to grade 12, public school, never had an issue, did great. The rest of us, I think Jeremy finished 11 and then went pioneering. Justin, I think he finished grade 10, he went to work. Jared finished grade 10, went to work. I finished grade 10, went to work. And it was just, that was fine. My parents never, they always left it as like a choice, you know, like you should get to high school and then it's up to you because the system's, it's not going to last. Like it, there was no thought to your future, you know, in that sort of way, right? You didn't think about retirement. You didn't think about your education helping you as far as your livelihood. And you certainly didn't think about finances. You just thought about working enough to get by in the system because it wasn't going to be here long.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. So now, of course, they say hindsight is 20/20, but looking back on it, you know, what would be your recommendation to people who are facing the same situation that you are? If they have a choice over homeschooling or not, what would you recommend them to do?
Oh, stay in school for sure. Yeah, I don't, even just the, it's not even the education part of it, but the whole, just getting to know other kids and dealing with teachers and shaping your goals in a way that makes you think about your future. We're just so short-sighted, as witnesses that you don't plan for anything and you don't experience anything because I wanted to grow up fast for some reason. And so at grade 10, I was already at the point where I was wanting to finish, be done with school, be working, you know, looking towards having a family. And I was, I don't know, how old are you in grade 10?
14.
14. Yeah. So that's, it's too young to be, you know, to be at that point. But that, like that whole getting baptized at 11, and then it was like I was taking steps before I should have been. And then you're an adult all of a sudden.
Yeah. So. I mean, this is the story of the personal story is just amazing because as I'm listening to this, everything is, we know now is going to impact a person down the road. Lisa, let me ask you this question because, you know, you've never been one of Jehovah's Witnesses, but when you would hear Nash relate his personal life experience, as you look back from your personal background, whatever church you may belong to, your family, when you heard this, what did you think?
I think there's certain things that I just had no idea that was a part of that. The education thing actually really surprised me. I had no idea that there was like no value put on post-secondary or, and I mean, I grew up with two sisters, so three girls, and we were always, I mean, I think we just all knew we would go to college and that's what our parents wanted for us. And they helped us get there and because it was important. And you never know what life's going to bring you and where you're going to end up. And you need to have something to fall back on. I went to school for nursing and then my other sister's a nurse and the other one's a speech pathologist. So, but it's nice to know that we all have careers and something to fall back on if things go wrong or... Yeah. And it makes you feel like you have an important role in a place. Not that staying home with the kids isn't an important role. I did that for quite a few years with my kids. But it is nice to have like a grown-up job to go to. And I worry for his girls because they already talk about not wanting to go to school and it's going to take too long and they're not even really sure why yet, but they're just being told that. So we try our best to push how important it is. But they're already both kind of like, I don't want to go to college. And that's hard to hear, I think.
Yeah. Anything with schooling involved right away, they're already, oh, that's too many years school. They're not to the point, their mom doesn't do the whole, like you should be a pioneer thing. I haven't heard that yet, thankfully, but they definitely, when we talk about careers or future, Eden will right away just be like, I don't,
nope,
that's too many years in school. if it's anything that has to do with school, she's just, nope, I don't want to do that. I want to work at McDonald's and she doesn't even realize, like, it's frustrating to watch because she doesn't realize what's going on there. That's that culture that's being bred into her where you don't, they make you not want to make that choice. It's crazy that they can do that. They don't have to tell you. They just make you know. You know, you don't go to college.
Yeah, we on our website, in a lot of the videos we do, we stress, you know, the two aspects of witness life, the teachings and the culture. If you do a little research, it's amazing. You go all the way back to Charles Taz Russell. And Charles Taz Russell, in his day, he was actually telling parents, don't send your kids to high school. Don't waste going to high school. So what that lets you understand better is that from the very inception of this religious group, their disdain for higher education has always been there. It's nothing new. And so when you hear a witness try to deny that as a religious denomination, they discourage higher education, they try to downplay it because they try to be very specific. They say, well, we're not banned from going to college. Well, who in the world bans their children from going to college? We're talking about, do you encourage it or do you discourage it? And so that's kind of what you run into many times.
Well, with Mackenzie and her.
Yeah, we've seen that. And I mean, my niece went through the same thing. I remember it was a big deal in the family because they all of a sudden said, she went to her parents and said, I don't want to be a witness anymore because I want to be a school teacher. I want to go to university and be a teacher. And the family rallied around and all of a sudden they said, you know, you don't have to leave just to go to college. You know, you could still do that if you really wanted to, but just take some time and think about it, you know, and really weigh your options. And then they got an older sister in there and she studied with her and everybody just surrounded her. And next thing you know,
she's not going.
She's still working at McDonald's and she's not, she didn't go to university. She stayed a witness and that was 4 years ago. And it's all, yeah. And now
I mean, it is real. That's for sure. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So what eventually happened when, so you get baptized and then all of a sudden you grow up, you know, you're this 10th grader, you go work. And then how did you meet your wife?
Just a very classic Jehovah's Witness convenience story. We're in small town Alberta and there's really not much for, you know, young single men and women. And so you go with what's convenient. And so she was, we were the same age. We grew up in the same hall. We didn't really know each other. I knew her dad wasn't a witness. So they were always kind of this quiet family that didn't really, you know, they weren't really involved in a lot of things because they didn't have a spiritual head, you know, up on the platform. So, yeah, we decided to date and I think we got married. I don't even think we dated a year. And we were married at 19. And then,
wow. Yeah. Young marriages in the witness religion is very, very common. If you don't go off and pioneer or serve where the need is great or go to Bethel, for most witness kids, they will, to avoid getting, quote unquote, getting in trouble, they will end up getting married young. And as you look back now, this type of cultural environment, what does it do when it puts young people in that type of predicament from what you have personally seen and experienced?
Well, I agree with you 100%. Like I don't think I ever had that desire to pioneer. I didn't love the preaching work. We were always involved in the regional building committee because we were in construction. So we were always there. I loved that part of it because it was something I enjoyed doing anyway. I enjoy giving talks, that side of things, you know, moving up the ladder of our, you know, of the Jehovah's Witnesses for brothers. That was a good thing. So marriage seemed like my option, right? I didn't want to go to Bethel. I didn't want to pioneer. So I needed to get married and that was it. It was almost like a step that you took in life. And so rather than figure out who you are, on an individual level and make some, you know, even make a couple relatively bad decisions as a young person and figure that out, you just go with what's there. And your choices are basically, does that person comment? Did they go to the meetings? Have they been in trouble for anything? That's good. I'll marry them. And then you get stuck in this incompatible relationship and you don't, and then it's too late. And then what do? Now you've signed off your life to Watchtower at 11. And now you signed off your life to somebody that you don't really know at 19. And there you go. The rest is history.
So when did you really realize that you had made the wrong decision in this marriage?
I mean, we started to have issues right on our honeymoon. Like the first week of marriage, we started having issues. But I never thought that this would end, right? Nobody thinks that way. You go into marriage and you're like, we're going to make this work. And I saw, you know, I saw my parents' marriage wasn't, and nobody's marriage is perfect, but I saw like some serious issues there, but I saw them stick it out. Like my dad moved into the basement when he was in his 30s and he's had his own room ever since. And I just saw that as like, well, that's what you do. You know, like it's just, you just stick it out. It doesn't matter. You figure it out. And so we just carried on. And I always was of the opinion that if you put the truth first, you know, like if you're having problems, it's because you're not doing something right, right? You're not going to service enough. You're not praying enough, studying enough. So we'd go through all those motions. We'd try and study together. We'd study the family book, or we would go in service more, or, you know, and we were always regular at the meetings, but it never mattered because whenever those issues would arise, there was no real talk, no real goal to make it better. It was just, we need to be better witnesses, and then it'll fall in line, and it never did. And so from that point, I started to, we moved away to another town and kind of had a fresh start, what we thought was a fresh start. And so in 2001, I was appointed as a ministerial servant. So I was 21, and a good friend of mine who was in the hall there that I met, he was appointed the same night. And then we decided to start. So then 9/11 happened. Everybody was in a panic about the world and the end was coming. And so that next spring or summer, we started regular auxiliary pioneering with a goal to start pioneering. And I remember there was a circuit overseer, Dale Clark. At the time, he was like a young up and coming circuit overseer. Him and his wife were young. He left, he was a flight attendant. I think he was going to be a pilot. And then he left that to be a witness, you know, and he's really climbed on. And everybody loved this guy. He's super charismatic. And I remember him, he took my wife and I aside and told me how, you know, you could be a circuit overseer, Nation. You got all the, you know, and really made you feel good and feel like,
oh, yeah,
I could be a circuit overseer. This guy is great and he thinks I'm great and I should probably do this. And so we, you know, we talked about it and we thought, boy, this could be it. But I think we didn't really want it, right? You know how when you think this is what it should do, but a part of you is just screaming, you don't want to do this. And so we decided, well, I think we'd been talking about having kids. We've been married for 4 years or so, and 3 years. Anyway, we're like, well, if we end up getting pregnant, then we'll stop pioneering. But if we don't, then we'll go pioneering. So we got pregnant, and that was easier than pioneering.
It wasn't easy pioneering.
So we had our first son, and we both quit pioneering, and then I just went back to work, and I stayed a ministerial servant for a year or two later, and then got into a little issue there. We probably don't have time to talk about, but something to do with my brother. And anyway, I was removed as a servant, and then just never, I never worked towards getting appointed again. Yeah. We were always regular, and I was never a regular in service. We always went to all the meetings, but like at that point, we were we were really giving her, you know, we were up at the assembly parts. I was in the drama that year when, and my wife at the time was a week overdue with the baby. And I was in the drama that day, which was ridiculous. And so then we just kind of fell into that mold of the Witness family that just kind of went to the meetings and went service and had kids. And that was what we did.
So how many kids did you end up having then?
I have four now altogether. I had three at that point that were all fairly close in age. But so we decided to move back home, back where our families were, where our parents were. And Jared and I worked together, my older brother, in Grand Prairie where we were. And then we decided in 05, there was some acreage lots for sale back home. They were a good price. We had a big talk and we knew my dad was getting older and he didn't have any kind of retirement plan or anything. So we thought if we went back and I started a business, we all worked together. If he worked for us, we could get to a point where he didn't have to work so much and we could just continue to pay his wage, right? And that was the plan. So we moved back in 05 and started the business in 06. And then the business went well, like things were good. And then it started to have a few issues. After 08, there was a financial crisis and stuff, but we seemed to hold pretty steady through all of it and had lots of work. And then that brings us up to the next kind of cratering moment in my life. So through all this time, I think I'd been married for quite a while at this point. Mm-hmm. And our marriage was never good. And, you know, lots of trying. And after 12 years, I kind of got to that point where I'd kind of stopped trying. And I stuck myself into work. I really loved work and I loved the business. And so I put that ahead of things. I still got to the meeting, still got out of service. But I'd checked out quite a bit at home. And she had checked out and was happy to just look after the kids. And so we were just kind of doing our own thing. But I always felt lots of guilt for it, right? I knew what I was doing wasn't good. And I knew that pursuing my business was a terrible choice and work was a terrible choice. And I should be doing more for the truth is what I thought. And for my family. And Jared, he never was the kind of guy that wanted to, you know, be a pioneer or be a ministerial servant or anything. Right. But he was a real perfectionist, hardest working guy. And you know, loved his family and he just worked himself to the bone and was hard on himself, always hard on himself. And so I think at this point, we were all working together. He's older than Jared. We were all together on this one project. We were building a big, you know, multi-million-dollar home. And Justin and I, Justin was always up and down, you know, wanting to do more for the truth and less. And I've called it the truth way too many times, but that's what we called it.
Yeah. That's true.
So that's for ease of
words, right?
Yeah, we know it's not, but that's what it was. So at this point we thought we would Memorial Month was coming up in April 2011, and so everybody wants to auxiliary pioneer for Memorial Month. That's always the big push. And so Justin and I decided to with our families, and we were trying to push Jared to do it too and his family. And he didn't want to, right? And he just kind of got quiet about it. Like he seemed irritated with us because once in a while he would jump in, but he seemed irritated that, you know, we were trying to push him into this. And so the first was a Friday, second was a Saturday, and Jared's family all went to the city for the day. And he thought Justin and I would be gone out in service that day because it was the first Saturday of the month for pioneering. But we didn't. We went to work. And I texted him to see if he'd come out to work. And he asked me that. He said, I thought you guys would be in service. And I said, no. So he went he came to work finally, but he was off a little bit and quiet, but he was like that sometimes. So I kind of ignored it. And he was kind of around the job site and stuff and didn't see him much. And then Justin and I got called in. They were doing some renovations at the Kingdom Hall and they were having a big lunch there. And I think I texted Jared and asked if he wanted to come and he didn't answer. It was a big job site, so it was not unusual to not see each other for a little bit. And so Justin and I went to town and I don't know, something felt off. We were at the hall and we ate and visited with people. And then our way back, I just got a sick feeling driving back to the job site that something wasn't right. And we drove in and Justin went in the house and I went to our job shack. And then, that's when I found him, Jared, and, he took his life in the job shack. So that was a pretty devastating moment and kind of started, you know, our whole, everyone's lives on a different trajectory from there on. I called one of the brothers in the hall because my dad was working at the hospital for us at the time. So I was worried he was going to hear through the paramedics, and he did hear through the paramedics, but we were from that town. So everyone was pretty good. The nurses were there for him and nobody let him leave. So, that's how that went.
Wow. That's all I can say. That personal experience. And this is why we think people need to be aware of how the culture, the internal pressure, the need to always do more, jump higher, run faster. It is unrelenting. And for people who are who find themselves under this pressure, it can literally push them literally, as in the case in your family, literally over the edge. Mental health, concern about people's well-being. These things are not something that the organization has ever addressed and dealt with well, because so many of the things that people have to deal with in this organization, unfortunately, they're actually artificially created. We did a thing about the pioneering. This is really a man-made concept. It has nothing to do with the Bible. It has nothing to do with God. And yet people, if they're unable to participate in these things, or either, as we were told at one of our conventions, if you are not a pioneer, do you at least have the desire to pioneer? And if you don't have the desire, then you need to be praying to Jehovah to get the desire. So even if this is not something you want to do, like, well, I don't want to pioneer, they'll make you feel guilty even then. And so this constant do more, beat, run fast, and it's unrelenting. And you will never in this organization reach that point. After this situation with your brother, because he was a baptized witness, how was it handled in your congregation?
Surprisingly, it was handled better than I thought it would, because there has been other suicides and I've seen them where they won't let the funeral be in the hall, or people can be insensitive about it. But I think because of our family, you know, who we were, and we were well known, and we were from there, and we were well known in the community too. And Jared was never in trouble his whole life. Like, he was a good witness, but he wasn't a ladder climbing witness. Like, he never liked it. I know he didn't. He didn't like to be early for the meetings. He liked to leave right after. He never commented. He didn't, but he did it because he felt he had to, and he believed it. And he right down to his letter, you know, he talks about doing more for Jehovah, you know, he's telling his wife and kids to love Jehovah and make sure they put him first. Like, he couldn't. So he always had that guilt, that like that shame. He just couldn't, he didn't have the desire to do it. He felt awful because he didn't have the desire to do it. And he didn't know what to do with himself because he felt like there was something inherently wrong with him for not wanting it. Because this is it, right? This is the answer. Like you should, who doesn't want the answer? There's something wrong with you. And I remember him having people talk to him like that, you know, like, Jared, you just gotta go to more meetings. You just gotta have a family study with your family. You know, like this will fix everything. And it didn't. And that's where he ended up. Yeah. So they had a big funeral at the Kingdom Hall. The hall was full. They rented the community center and the school gym, and it was full too. And they streamed it over to there because the community came and lots of people came.
But that it was so amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah, but it was a classic Jehovah's Witness funeral, right? It was about 3 minutes about Jared, and then it was just a propaganda sales pitch and a heart-wrenching song for everybody to cry about and come join our religion.
Right.
Yeah. We tell people this is what the person would have wanted you to do.
You know, obviously Jared was not disfellowship when he committed suicide.
No.
And a lot of the times when we're online, we'll hear that that's what drove people to suicide. And so did you all notice anything about Jared other than just him not wanting to do Jehovah's Witness stuff that could have given you, tipped you off that something could be wrong?
I don't think we thought anything could be that wrong. I mean, we knew he struggled and he did talk to us sometimes, Justin and I, and my dad, you know, he had the usual, he had some family issues that had gone on. Some of the stuff was hidden. Nobody really knew about it until after. You know, he had some marital issues that were pretty normal, nothing extraordinary. But there wasn't like a, you know, for all intents and purposes, Jared seemed like, you know, he seemed like he'd pull through. Like he seemed like that guy that he always made people laugh, and he was funny and upbeat and just super driven. So it was unexpected. Once you look back, then you can say, oh yeah, that should have, you know, I should have took that more serious or whatever, right? Because we would make flippant comments sometimes, like, you know, you'd be better off dead, or, you know, that kind of thing. But I know, and I battled with lots of guilt after myself for saying that kind of stuff, you know, when we'd be in these conversations where, you know, if you're going to talk about it, just do it. Which, looking back now, I can't believe I even said that kind of stuff. But it just seems so unbelievable, or so like just not a possibility to me at the time, that we just thought, you know, don't stop looking for attention, or why would you say that? Like, that's, you're not going to do that. And then when it happens, then yeah, too late.
So did you all get help with therapy, the family, after his death?
No, no. I don't know if anybody else ever did go to a therapist. I know, I went to the, like a physician, to a doctor, over it, cause I couldn't sleep, and, they diagnosed me with post-traumatic stress, and put me on antidepressants and any anxiety meds to deal with it. But I never saw a psychologist. They sent me to a psychiatrist who was an elder in the one town, and he just wrote me prescriptions, and that was it. So nobody really talked to anybody about it. And then I self-medicated with alcohol is what I did. So that's what led me down a terrible road for myself, where I kind of self-destructed, because rather than get help or even look for help, I just tried to carry on and work and, you know, and come home. And then I would try and drink in secret on my own, usually just so I could get to sleep at night. But it doesn't work. And anybody who's been through that knows that doesn't work. So that,
yeah, because, you know, when we, if we can just go back to your brother's situation, I remember you were saying that he felt this was the truth, so he didn't want it, but he thought something was wrong with him. So if he could have probably had another outlet, you think things could have turned out differently for him?
Yeah, for sure. And now, yeah, no, looking back, like, that's one of the biggest things is I wish he would have known he had a choice. None of us felt like we had a choice. You know, this was the choice. And if you didn't like that choice, there's something wrong with you. And I know his wife has said that to me now. She's no longer in, and she says the same thing. Like, I wish I could tell him. I wish I could tell him what I know now. I wish he had a chance, because there would have been a good life for him. But he didn't see that, because there was either put the organization first and these goals that have been set for you, or you might as well be dead, because you probably got a better shot than you do if you just live your life doing nothing.
Yeah, and that's why we think that your interview and your story is so important, because, as you know, we're speaking, there are people right now that, like last week, I just heard someone committed suicide. So it's almost like if they could just hear stories like this, it can really help them to see that there is life outside of this organization. And of course, it's not just about the religion too, because other people, there's people that commit suicide, not because they're Jehovah's Witnesses, because they're dealing with other issues. But there's also support groups, there's resources, and, you know, I looked up a number of resources and I've put them in the description of this video so that if anybody is dealing with this issue, they can take a look at these resources to help out people. And even people that are in a situation that are feeling suicidal, because no one is talking about that to other people. They're not saying, I want to kill myself or anything like that. They're just walking around feeling bad, but they don't realize that they don't have to walk around and deal with it on their own.
Yeah.
So once you woke up from once you woke up to know that this is not the truth, what did you do in terms of getting help after the fact, once you realized you could get help?
Well, to skip way forward past a bunch of things, when I finally woke up and was in a healthier place, knowing what I, you know, knowing kind of the truth about the truth, I found a psychologist that I could talk to, and I regularly saw her, and she helped me to just kind of work through it. And it's not like it's some magic thing they say or tell you to do, but it's just having somebody to listen, to put a little bit of input into it and help you put it together to realize that these things you're feeling are okay. They're, you know, they're normal for what you've been through, and that there's better ways to deal with it. They give you some healthy coping mechanisms. And the biggest thing is having those, you know, those healthy coping mechanisms, recognizing those feelings when they come, recognizing, you know, what grief is or when anger comes or whatever it is, and knowing how to deal with it, that you don't have to hide from it. You know, you don't have to act out. You just need to sometimes sit in it, get through it, and recognize it for what it is and go past. And sometimes it takes medication, I guess, and whatever, that's definitely a thing. I know for myself, once I got to that place and I just had a psychologist, and I read a ton of books and different articles on all of this, and especially about the organization. I think that was one of the biggest things for me, was working through that indoctrination that had been in me, or that's still probably in me, and trying to get that sorted out in my own head. And once I had that, you know, it seemed to come, not easy, but it came more naturally. I think it's natural to want to point the finger or blame something when something happens like suicide. And I think it's natural for people to do that right away. They might blame, for sure you blame yourself. You might even blame someone else. I know I acted out. I've been through this and we've sorted it out between Jared and his wife. I blamed her for a while. You know, said and did things I'm not proud of in the moment when a person is dealing with grief. And we've all done that, like in our situation. And we've, you know, for the most part, we've sorted through all those things. But the one thing you never, ever even considered pointing a finger at, and it's not because it needs, it's not that one thing needs to be blamed, but there are reasons a person gets to that point in their life. But you never point the finger at Watchtower. You would never even consider that that had anything to do with it. And that was when I came out and pointed any blame, that's when things changed between me and my parents. Because my mom accused me right away of blaming Watchtower for Jared's suicide. And it's not like I don't blame Watchtower 100% for Jared's suicide. But that had a massive amount to do with it. Because I know in my own situation, I came close to suicide. And I know that it's that feeling of that there's nothing else. You know, that's the only answer. And so if you can't do that, you might as well be dead. Because you're no good to anybody. You're no good to yourself. You're no good to your kids. You're no good to this world. Anybody who loves you or relies on you, they're going to get let down because you're not putting Jehovah first. You're not being a good spiritual head or a good, you know, like that. That's first and foremost. And it doesn't matter how far away you get from it. If you don't get that out of your brain, you'll always feel less than. You'll always feel guilty and you'll never feel good enough. And Lisa and I got together in spring of 2017. Finally, I'd separated from my wife and moved out. And so we were kind of together at this point. And she's, you know, like over the last 4 years, probably the reason I'm still here for the most part. But like even at that point, I had started to take steps away from the organization. You know, I'd taken a huge step in moving on from a bad marriage, but I hadn't figured myself out yet, and I certainly hadn't even started to think about my beliefs. I just knew that I wasn't good enough for it, and I knew I wasn't probably going back. But I didn't think it was wrong. I still felt that it was right. And even though I had doubts and even though I had gone through all this terrible stuff, it didn't matter. I still felt like there was no point. And so, you know, so now I'm in this relationship, which is a great relationship. But I'm still struggling at that time. And so I'm still drinking, but now I think I kind of got it under control because I feel pretty good most of the time, but I don't. And I'm just ignoring it. And I'm not seeing a psychologist yet at this point. Maybe the odd time. I don't think I saw her then.
No, I don't think so.
No. So still thinking I kind of got this under control. I can do it. You know, maybe I can just live life and be happy and live out my life and whatever, you know, hopefully my kids get to paradise. So that made me pull back from my kids because I felt like I wasn't doing them any good. You know, everybody was shunning me at this point, so none of that mattered. But now I got this person that I love and who relies on me. And a part of me feels tons of guilt for not being good enough for her either. Because now I know I'm bringing her down with me. We're going to die together because Armageddon's coming. It's any day. And that just kept... No matter what happened, it seemed like, no matter how many steps I'd take forward, I kept just taking steps back. And drinking just continued to be a problem for me, you know, drinking in secret. And it didn't matter. And looking back, like there was lots of reasons to be happy. And I should have just been able to, you know, to pick up my socks and go. but I didn't. And that culminated in me getting to a point where I ended up getting put in a psych ward for a week, 2 weeks. Yeah,
a week and some.
And so at that point, I was kind of at such a low spot. We decided we couldn't really be together at that point because I was, you know, like she has kids and that lived with us. And so it wasn't good for me to be around. So I felt like, then I really felt like there's, you know, I don't know what to do. I've got no family. I've got no friends. I pretty much ruined, I felt like I'd ruined our relationship at the time. And she didn't feel like that. And she was, but you know, I didn't know what to do. I was alone. I got let out of the hospital and I had to go stay with my only friend left in his basement, in a town an hour away. And so I just did what I would have become accustomed. And I grabbed a bottle for what I thought would be the last time. And then I got arrested. And then I spent 7 months in jail. Right from there, I never got out between there. And that was kind of it. That was it for me. That was my last drink I took. That was some forced time on my own to think. I didn't get, I wish I could have got an easier way to do it. But sometimes you need to get hit pretty hard to stop. And so that's what stopped me from everything. And so I read a ton while I was in there, whatever I could. I read my Bible a ton with no kind of watchtower influence. And it just kind of started to fall in line that it wasn't special. The witness doctrine wasn't special to me. You know, I always felt like we had it all figured out. And the more I met some Muslims, Seventh-day Adventists, Christians, went to all the sermons and met some of the pastors and would have discussions with them. And I realized that they all were very similar. Everybody kind of believed the same thing in different ways. And they all, you know, they all had in common that they all thought they were right. They all thought they were the only one. And I thought only we felt like that, but it's not. So after that terrible experience, which I wish had never happened, you know, it doesn't really matter because in the end, when I got out and everything's, you know, fast forward, maybe that's what I needed. I wish it isn't, but I'm here now, and I don't think I'd be the person I am today had I not gone through all of that. You know, maybe I would. I don't know. But whatever it is, it's made me who I am today. And I know I have a lot more patience and empathy for people that struggle with things, whether it's mental health or whether it's some kind of substance abuse or just emotional problems. I know my nieces, I keep pretty close contact with them one's being shunned and by her family. And I feel for them and I genuinely feel for them. Whereas I don't think in the past I would have felt for them the same way had I not been through that stuff. Because once you experience it, you know, you just understand in a way that people can't that haven't been through it.
Yeah, it makes us better people many times. One of the things that you pointed out is basically the Achilles heel for this organization. In many denominations, they have people who may struggle with alcohol, and they try to help them. They will put them into programs. They will set up programs in many churches. In the organization, they will not help you. Perfect example. A person comes in and the elders will meet with a person and they will say, well, tell me, Joe, how many times did you get drunk in the past 30 days? And the person will be honest and say, you know, I got drunk four times this past month. Now, the person doesn't realize that part of the elder's training is to see, can we build a case that you are making this a practice?
Yeah.
And so the person is thinking, I'm being honest with the elders, letting them know what I'm going through. And he says, well, I got drunk four times this month. And the elder's like, this is a practice. Brother's making a practice of this. Brother's got a practice of this. Well, you see, that's because the elders have no training. See, if they were actually professionals in the field, they wouldn't find that shocking or unusual at all for someone who is struggling with this issue. But because they are not trained, you know, it's as if elders are the jack of all trades, but they're the masters of none. And so they now are going to use this literally as the basis to disfellowship a person, because the Watchtower teaches if the person is involved in a practice, those are the grounds for disfellowshipping. When in fact, the person got drunk four times because he's dealing with something. The elders are not trained to look for, well, what is the underlying reason? Is something going on in your life, Joe? Is something happening? They're not trained for that. So you have these untrained men who are going to render a decision that is going to impact the person's life for decades, destroy families. Whereas if you was over in church ABC, you know, they would have some program or something set up for you.
Yeah, that's one of the things I said right away about the witnesses and the elders is the things that they deal with are things that people go to school for years to deal with, right? Like those traumatic situations, addiction. Those are things that people go to school for years to train for. And these guys are just doing their thing. And causing
Joe Blow Elder. Joe Blow Elder.
Yeah.
And they feel important. They feel,
yes.
They feel like this is really, and I remember even being an MS, you feel like you're let into this club. You know, you're just kind of like you're in the club of these guys that seem to know a little more what's going on. And then the elders are just that much more, you know, because they stick to each other and they have their little, you know, conversations about everybody. And they feel pretty important because they are. They get a lot of say in your life. And it's funny with the shunning. And I know it works. You know, it's blackmail. We all know that. But it's funny how if they looked at it, like if I talked to one of the brothers who I was good friends with that disfellowshipped me, and I said to him, you know, if you would have let me hang around, if you guys would have just let me hang on, I would have never left. I would have never left. I would have struggled the rest of my life or killed myself, but I would have died a witness. And that is the reality. Kicking me out twice. It took, that's when it finally was enough. And it's not like, I think they're so deluded that they don't realize that if a person's pushed far enough away, eventually he might look somewhere and realize that this is nonsense. This is all nonsense. And I've been lied to my whole life. And when it happened, when you realize that, you can't unsee it. You can't stop. You can't just be like, well, that doesn't matter, because your whole life was based on a lie and you can't believe it. And you look at all the people you love and that were in your life and you just want to shake them and say, they're lying to you, but you can't.
Yeah, you're right. That's why people ask JT, if the organization changed so-and-so, would you go back? I'm like, you gotta be out of your mind. You gotta be out of your mind.
Right.
Because the problem is the whole premise, the whole foundation upon which the organization is built is bogus. There are 8 guys in the United States that can tell me everything to do in my life, and I'm supposed to follow them. So once you get down to the foundation, the core, you know, you're there with nothing. So you know, I tell people, I can go back, these same guys. No, absolutely not.
No.
You know?
Right. So, Lisa, what was your biggest challenge in helping Nash out in your relationship?
Oh, which one?
I think a lot of times it's hard because you feel quite helpless. A person really, you can try to do all of the things, but you really had to come to it on your own. And I think it took me a long time. Like, I would say even just this past year to like really understand how he must have felt when he was coming out of it and starting to realize that it wasn't like there were for sure stages of it where, you know, you started questioning it. And it's hard for me because I didn't know a lot about it, just what he had said and been through. But sort of feeling like sometimes I feel like, oh, okay, like he gets it and it's not real, but not really even. Like it took a very long time for him to fully realize that it wasn't true and no one's going to paradise. And like you said, you kind of felt like you had to deal with your brother's deaths all over again because you're not going to see them in paradise. And
yeah, it was a lot of grief, right?
Yes.
Now you grieve the actual losses. You grieve the family that's still alive that's wrote you off like you never existed. You grieve your immortality that you thought you had. Everything. The loss of your youth. You know, I'd love to have my younger years back again. I'm not that old, but I definitely feel pretty old compared to what I did 10 years ago.
And you miss out on a lot.
Yeah, you miss out on that. And like Lisa tells me, you know, just that normal growing up, being a teenager or being in your early 20s and, you know, doing stuff that young people do. And I see it a lot, people my age that get out and they'll go off the rails and try to get that back, you know, like they want to party, they want to do all that. And I'm thankful I never, despite all of my stupidity and missteps, I never felt that that kind of that loss in that way that I needed to go do that. Right. I didn't need to start hitting strip clubs and doing coke and, you know, trying every bloody thing you could think of that some people go do to make up for something that I never had. Right. Because the reality is, you know, Lisa wasn't doing hard drugs and, you know, like, you know how we think that
that's exactly right.
You know, we think kids, the worldly people are in their early 20s. We see these pictures in the Watchtower and everybody's got, you know, needles and cash and, you know, it's dark and smoky. And it's like, that's what you think the world is, but it's not. You know, they may get drunk once in a while when they're young and party a bit and that's it. But it's not the focus of their life. It's just a little stage in their life and they keep moving. And things keep going forward and we get stuck in this rut sometimes where we think that that's what the world is and that's what I'm going to be. And you're not that, like, you don't have to be that.
That's an excellent point. That's an absolutely excellent point. And Lisa, my wife and I, the reason we wanted to have you on the show is because there are a lot of people that we have talked to, that we have worked with, that we've gone out with dinner and had over to the house and conversations with, who are in your exact situation. And I think it's good to see persons like yourself. We have talked to so many people, even right now, just a few days ago, not too long, people who they are married to a former Jehovah's Witness. And for them, it is a very challenging situation because your family and your friends, if you try to talk to them and tell them now it's going to be secondhand, they'll look at you like, girl, I don't know what you're into. You know? and so we want to just commend you because whether you realize it or not, and we talk about this all the time, individuals like you, you're able to bring and help a former witness find stability because that's what they need in their life is someone who can bring a perspective to the table that's not built on just being a former witness themselves. So and the dynamics are different with every person. Some people, they leave, they marry another former witness, and some they leave and they may marry someone who's not. But for a person like yourself, you're in a very unique position, and there are a lot of people who are going to see this video, and they're going to be looking at you like, that's me. That's the same thing I'm with it. And so it's good to see people like yourself who understand and who have stuck with this person Because it would have been very easy for you to say, you know what, Nash, I'm going to ghost you next week. You know, and so he'd be texting you, you don't answer back.
But the beauty, you know? See, for me, is the beauty of this whole thing is she saw something beautiful in you,
yeah.
Nash, because this is what I see taking place all the time. Where, you know, it's hard for people to get partnered with someone that's ideal. And what I'm seeing a lot of times is there's a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses, they wake up and then people find out, hey, look, this is a good person. And they're not gonna, let you go get out of their life, you know. And so they see those qualities because there's some positive things about our upbringing. The kind of people we are as well. You know, yeah. after we left the religion, we're still the same people, you know, that we were when we were Jehovah's Witnesses. So we didn't like throw everything out, you know, with the bathwater kind of thing.
Yeah, that's an excellent point because, and this is just my personal opinion, at the core, the average Jehovah's Witness is a very good person because it takes a good person to put up with this type of stuff.
Yeah.
And so we've talked to a lot of people who they have gotten involved with, like a witness man. He's taught a certain way. A witness woman is taught a certain way. And some of the qualities that we are taught, they will make a good spouse or a good husband or a good wife. And so when people like yourself meet them, like, this is an honest man. This guy's honest. He's an honest man. And so people get to see that. And so I think it's very important that we don't leave persons like yourself out because you're not out. Everything that he goes through, you go through. I mean, that's just the way it is, especially, you know, when you're in a relationship.
Yeah.
And so that's that. And I think it's good. So, you know, we just want to commend you for putting up with what has got to be the craziest type of environment that you could ever think someone actually lived and grew up in. I mean, it's... Yeah.
So, Lisa, did you find yourself going online and watching extra Jehovah's Witness videos? What did you get your education online?
Yeah,
I think we watch a lot of them together.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like I'll listen to just podcasts and stuff like that because it's very interesting to me now too. It's funny, there are a lot of people that that we talk to that are like very interested to hear about it. I think because of a lot of the stuff that you've been doing and like putting himself out there. Lots of people have approached us in town and just like are quite interested to know it because nobody really realizes how crazy it is.
I told you, Nash. I told you that they call us crazy. I told you.
Straight nuts. One of the doctors, I think, noticed. Well, because we were in that little documentary on YouTube and I think we had a couple people in town just approach us out of the blue and say, hey, we saw you guys in that in that documentary. Yeah. So then they want to talk about it. And so it's good. It's got it's put a huge target on my back in this town because there's, you know, this is 10,000 people is all that's here. And I grew up here and everyone knows us. And my parents live just a couple blocks from me. And the witnesses, there's some that just they despise me. Because they're hearing about it, you know, when they call on people's doors, because I've been told by people what they've said to them, you know, they came with the magazines on A Happy Family. And the one guy, you know, he's known my family forever. And he said, I'm good friends with Nash. And he says, there's no family happiness going on there. Like, take your magazine and go. And I know he's not the only one. So.
Yeah, and I think that's really the whole thing about what we do. I will tell people all the time, we talk about this, if a person wants to become one of Jehovah's Witnesses, that's a personal choice. I would never tell anyone to leave the organization, and I would never tell anyone not to stay with Jehovah's Witnesses. But what I would say, we are consumers. We consume information, products, and services. It is important that before you become one of Jehovah's Witnesses, that you know both sides.
Yeah.
And if you know both sides and then you decide to become a witness, then great. But like so many people, like your parents, my parents, because I've asked my folks, if they had known what they know now, they said, we never became a witness.
Right.
So when people, it's like buying a product. If you buy a product and you didn't know this thing was no good, would you have bought it Absolutely not.
Yeah.
So that's the whole thing about what we try to do. We let people look. This is what goes on behind the curtain. If you as an individual have no problem with this kind of stuff going on behind the curtain, then you're more than welcome to join.
Yeah.
But if you want to know, well, what are these people really about? Then we're going to tell you. We're going to let you see, as we say, we're going to let you see the good, the bad, and the ugly. And like you mentioned, people in your town, they now got a chance to literally take a peek behind the curtain. And for many people, once they peek behind that curtain, they're like, what's out front is just a facade. It's just a facade.
Yeah.
You know.
See, I like what Nash said. See, Nash has got a credibility with someone in the community that knows a person. And I feel like because that person was able to see you as an individual, I feel like they were able to then look at the Jehovah's Witnesses and realize that they were the lie, not you. And so, like you were saying before, you know, we felt like we were wrong because we didn't want the Watchtower. But then when you step away from the religion, make friends and be the true person that you are. And then the Jehovah's Witness comes and says, look, we are happy people. Then they're like, no, this is not true. You know, so you were able to do a reverse witness in town.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the crazy thing is with my history in these last few years, you know, like it's not a nice track record. On paper, it looks bad. Like there's some, you know, some terrible things that happened. And the reality is now that I've been open about it and pretty much everyone knows, and I don't try to hide it. Like it's not like a big secret. You know, I feel like I have, remember we always say freeness of speech, right? Freeness of speech when you're a brother, that's your thing. I feel like I actually have freeness of speech because I'm not pretending to be something I'm not, and I'm not trying to hide my past, and I don't run around advertising all the terrible things I did. But the reality is that I don't pretend like it never happened, and I don't pretend I'm somebody I'm not. And I know so many times as a witness, people that would like do things, move halls, and kind of hide from it. And that's, you know, I understand, but the reality is like that's just the way it was, because as a witness, you have this portrayal of yourself, and that's what you want everyone to see. That's what you want the world to see. You want to give a good witness, right? You want to make sure everybody sees that you're this perfect person, and that's not the person you are. You know, and it's different when I come out and now making different friends and worldly people, as we call them.
That was a funny one to me.
That was a funny one. Yeah, that's kind of cool.
He's
worldly. He's worldly.
Yeah, it's like, super. Oh, okay. I'm so worldly. But they have, you know, people in general have more of an understanding that, or more of an appreciation for people that go through things and get better, or, you know, or grow as an individual, or learn from their mistakes. And as witnesses, and it was interesting getting disfellowshipped and reinstated. That taught me that too. You're never looked at the same when you come back in. It doesn't matter what you did. It doesn't matter if you served your time for it with them. It doesn't matter. You never get back on the same playing field. Unless you move away somewhere where nobody knows about it and years have passed, you're going to be looked different at differently. And regular people don't do that. In reality, there's a lot of good people out there that want to prop you up for seeing what you've recovered from or the good you've done. And I've had you know, like some sincere people that I, you know, worldly people that knew me growing up that I never had any close contact with, but now have gotten to know. And, you know, they've offered to be my, you know, I've had these ladies say they want to be my mom or whatever, right? Because they know that my parents shun me. And these are just people that, like, you know, you're told that worldly people they're no real friends. They're just out to get you. They want your money. They want something from you. They always want something from you. They don't want anything from you. They don't want nothing from you. They don't expect anything from you, and they don't require anything from you. And it's totally different than what we thought.
It's an adjustment when you leave, because so many, we were given such a warped value system of people and issues and things. And so, like you were saying, for most people who find out that you may have had an issue, they're like, okay, that's cool, let's move on. And you're like, well, I did so-and-so. Okay, it's fine, let's move on. But like the witness, oh no, you're not gonna move. We're gonna hold you right here.
Well, that's because the witnesses are trained to spot wrongdoing. Yeah. Like we were talking this morning about how when you are a Jehovah's Witness, you're always on some kind of radar where people are looking to see if something looks like it's like you've committed an offense against the organization. And you could just be walking out of a store and some man could have walked out before you did and they could have swore up and down that you guys were together. You were walking a little too close to him. And there could be something going on, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's just terrible.
They were doing a lot of talking. They were walking down the sidewalk. I saw it. You know, in fact, I give you a perfect example. We had a situation when I was in New York. I was at Bethel. Circus Hill was talking about how the witness culture is just so crazy. Guy came out of a restaurant, and he was a worldly guy. He had a beard. A sister hugged him, and some witnesses saw it. And so what did they do? Well, sister so-and-so was out with a worldly man in a hotel, in a restaurant, and they had lunch or whatever together. What it turned out was, it was her brother. He was in town. He said, I want to grab lunch. But the witnesses, they saw this, and they just went off. We had another brother. He worked for the city of New York. He worked for the health department. His job was to test water. That was what he'd go to restaurants and, you know, test the water. And in New York, a lot of the restaurants, especially the little bars, the little dive places, they often leave the door open. You can walk past and see folks sitting inside and stuff, right? So he's sitting at the bar doing this, but he's sampling the water. And some witnesses saw him in there. He was in a club with this woman. She was sitting right beside him, you know. And he got pulled on the carpet. Turns out he was doing his job, getting paid. And so that is part of the culture of witnesses. Everybody is out to turn you in.
Yeah.
And so if you fall, make a mistake, they will take it as a statement about your love for God, who you are as a person. Whereas normal people, they just realize that's just the failings of a human. That's all.
Yeah.
That's all.
But it wouldn't even have been a failing of a human, because in the world, they don't, well, you know, like mainstream religions do not train their parishioners to go spy on people to turn them into the elders so they can now be disfellowshipped. They don't do that, you know?
Yeah. And the hypocrisy of, how many times do we sit there and listen to a talk about how Jehovah takes your sins and he washes them? And it's like this white sheet and it's got this spot on it. And then he just takes it and it's gone, man. You never see it again. And then good luck if you ever go into an elders meeting about something, because you, every one of those spots on that sheet are going to come out from the last 20 years, because that's how they can tell if you're repentant or not.
Yeah.
Like, right. Oh yeah, you did that 15 years ago and you're back.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
That's so true. Right. Where's the forgiveness?
Yeah.
It's terrible. So Lisa, has you ever been in contact and to know a Jehovah's Witness before you met Nash?
No, the only thing I remember, I worked at Boston Pizza when I was in my 20s, I guess. And I remember a kid there who was a Jehovah's Witness, but he had left. He decided to leave. And so, like, I remember hearing that his family wasn't talking to him and just feeling like, just thinking like, oh, that's sad. But, like, had no idea what he must have actually been going through. And he would come out. You know, we would go out and he would come out and party with us. And now I look back and I think he probably did those things and then felt major guilt in it. Like the guilt he must have been living through at the time. And I was just like oblivious to it.
Yeah. You know?
But that's really the only sort of like growing up that I remember with Jehovah's Witnesses. And then I remember ducking out of the window when they would come to the door, but that's about it.
Yeah. So now you've gotten a full education about what it's like to be raised in a high control group, or a lot of people call it a cult, but it's a good experience to know about, because then you don't get a chance, like when people come to you and you can see similarities about other teachings or other groups.
Yeah.
And even multi-level marketing can be so cult-like, you know, like a religion as well, that you know, you can just easily say, no, I'm not interested.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah. There's a lot of, I feel a lot of anger for him all the time towards his family. And there's been times, we just opened a store here in March, and Nash was sort of saying how, you know, he wishes his parents could be there and be a part of it, and was missing them. I could tell was missing them. So I reached out and sent them a text message asking if they wanted to come to the grand opening, and it just ended up in, it was a disaster. I never should have reached out.
But yeah, it goes downhill.
Yeah, it does. And but you just feel so angry that, I mean, they've lost two sons, and they're acting like he's dead, and I can't
wrap
my head around it.
And they put it on you. That's what's frustrating, is they turns, they get started out as like a nice invitation, you know, and an offer to help and whatever it might be. And I've learned my lesson in the last years. Like I don't provoke, right? I do my very best not to provoke. I don't swear around them. I don't, you know, I'm careful about what I say, because I don't want it to look, and I don't want it to upset them, right? And, but it immediately goes the other way. You did this. You chose this. You made this decision. You know what you're supposed to do. You know the truth. And I hate that saying. I hate when they tell you, you know the truth. That bothers me more than anything, because yeah, I know the truth. That's the reality. You don't. You don't.
Exactly. That's why I left. I know the truth.
Yeah. But they think that it, they think you, and they're just like, you could have it all back. You know what you have to do. And it's like, yeah, I do. I sure could, but I would never. Never.
No. You feel sorry for them because you understand, as, and this is part of the growing, and you eventually will, there are different phases that a person goes through when they leave the organization. They go through hurt, they go with anger, grief, and every emotion you go through, and eventually you will reach a point where you will find a certain measure of peace of mind. I mean, you're never going to be all the way where you want to be, because the relationship will always be strained.
Yeah.
But you will begin to better understand how to manage it. And I'm going to be honest with you, for some people, I'll tell you when you know you really have reached a certain point, is when you start to feel pity for them. It takes you back to what Jesus said. Jesus said, I looked at the people and I felt pity for them, because they were being thrown around and tossed about and kicked to the side by their leaders. And that's what we see. You see how whatever the governing body says something, they jump, they run. And after a while, you just feel sorry. These are grown people, 50, 60, 70, 80 years old. And yeah, Someone has to tell them, you know, what can they wipe their nose with, a Kleenex or toilet paper? You know, can I use, which one can I use? And so that's where this organization is. And as the days and the years go by, we're going to see more of that. The organization has no choice, because information and people like you are in the public eye. People are getting a different perspective. So for the people who are left, the organization has no choice but to demonize and berate and belittle those who've left even more. They don't have any choice. And I tell people, because that's what high control groups and cults do. As one guy always said, if you want to know if you're a part of a cult, observe how they treat you when you leave.
Yeah.
And that is the bottom line. Observe how they treat you when you leave.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So, do you have any final comments that you'd like to make to the listening audience about your overall experience, and both you and Lisa, you know, what you would want people to also take away from your experience?
I don't know. I think for me, the biggest thing, I guess, and the reason I wanted to tell my story, and there's a lot more to tell, but the reality is that I hope I can help people avoid the pitfalls that I went through. I hear these stories of these people, these, you know, folks that get out, even in your guys' case, for conscientious reasons, you realize it's not the truth and you leave. And, man, I just sit there and I'm like, I wish that was me. I wish I would have done that. But I didn't. And I don't sit around feeling bad about it. But the reality is, I hope that if I can tell my story and people can see that, you know, there's better ways, maybe they won't go so far, or maybe they'll realize that because they've made some mistakes, it doesn't mean it's over. You don't have to quit. You don't have to stop. you know, figure out who you are, get some real help. And you get lucky sometimes. I'm, you know, like Lisa stuck with me through more than she should have, and more than most people would. And I'm pretty lucky to have her. And that's out there for people. Like, you know, just stick with it and do the work and know you're worth it, and don't stop. That's my biggest thing I see people that still struggle because they don't take the time to do the research and do your own research. Don't watch a couple videos and say, good, that's enough. Read about it. Really do it. Like, really do it until you know in your heart that this is not what I thought it was. And you don't have to have all the answers. You don't have to research until you have an answer for everything, because you probably won't. But you need to figure out that what you thought you knew isn't what it is. And once you know that, you can start to take steps in your life in another direction. But if that's always there, it's like an anchor, and it will just drag you back. Doesn't matter how hard you push, it'll drag you down. And so I think that's my biggest thing is make sure you don't just think you're moving on, because you're not if you don't do the work.
Right.
Excellent point.
How about you, Lisa?
I think it's good having like people like you, and the people that speak out are such a huge part of it. Cause I think when people get out, they're so isolated. They don't have anybody to talk to. And it's important we're lucky that we have this stuff now, and that people can go on and see that they're not the only ones. And because, it'd be a pretty lonely place when you get kicked out like that all by yourself.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah, very good.
Well, thank you so much for coming out and telling your story, because I think it's so compelling. And I think that so many people can resonate with what you're saying. Even people who call themselves PMO, physically in but mentally out, they really rely on these type of videos because they're like at a tipping point. And they just don't know which way to go. And when they see and hear experiences like this, it really helps them.
Yeah, that's the whole point of what we try to do. And we just want to thank you guys for taking the time, giving us the time to interview you guys and share your experience. And we believe it will help people, because we have seen this over and over, the positive results of seeing someone who has gone through what someone else has gone through, seeing yourself through other people. It gives people the encouragement that they need. You know, I can make it too. And that's really all we want to try to do, is just let people know you do not have to give up. Hang in there.
That's right.
All right.
All right.
For sure.
This has been JT.
And this has been Lady C.
Thanks for having you and being in our audience today. All right.
All right.
Thank you guys so much, man. Y'all guys' experience, man, is just deep.
Very, I mean, very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's just deep. And
now the only thing we got to do is hope this thing was recorded.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine?
Oh my God.
Hey, this is Lady C. Thank you for tuning in to The Critical Thought. We appreciate having you in our audience. Not only that, but we invite you to subscribe to our channel and be sure to hit that bell so that you can receive notifications when we upload new content. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and give us a thumbs up if you like this video. Thank you for being in our audience.